Hello, everyone, and welcome to the 31st episode of the Next Stage Press podcast, where we talk theater and playwriting with the various artists of Next Stage Press. I'm your host, Gene Cato. Today's guest is an absolute master at the economics needed to craft a compelling story in a tight time frame. From her formative years as a dancer, she made the leap to playwriting after a career-ending injury sidelined her from continuing to participate in dance. I'm speaking of none other than Connecticut playwright Laura Thoma. Over the course of our conversation, Laura and I discussed such topics as how having a teacher littering a class assignment with red marks propelled her to pick up the pen full-time, how even in the darkest of stories, hope must remain eternal, and how the trope of parent-child conflict remains a constant no matter the day, year, week, or even decade. It was an insightful chat with a powerhouse writer compelling us to hope for the best in people as we see them struggling with that which is most difficult. So, let's go to that conversation.
Hello, Laura!
Hello, Gene. It's good to see you again.
So everyone that is listening to this episode is probably going to come straight out of the barrel going, why does Gene seem so animated right at the very, very beginning of it? Full disclosure here, Laura, you yes. and I are, we're meeting face-to-face for the very second time.
That is very true.
It's true. Here's what happened. I'm going to start. We had just an awesome interview for, well, I can't really say this episode. Is it this episode? It sort of is this episode. We went through the entire recording. Laura told me all these wonderful things about herself and her play and her writing and all that. And I was so enthralled that I did everything except hit the recording button.
Just a small detail.
So here we are. We're going back through this again for the second time today, but that's okay. It was kind of like a rehearsal the first time, and now
there
we're
you go.
So anyway, we were speaking with Laura Thoma today and about her play Magpie and all things theatrical with her and the writing process. So, Laura, welcome back to the Next Stage Press podcast.
Thank you. It's exciting to return in the same day.
You know, most people, it's months, sometimes years before they come back. Next Stage Press podcast. You did it in about 2 hours. Yes. So here we go. All right. Well, let's start this off. I always like to begin these episodes by having the listening audience, and they may or may not be familiar with your work. So this is the Cliff Notes version of your writing career, as I said last time. And so tell us how you began your theatrical journey towards playwriting.
Absolutely. Yeah, I kind of came a different route. I started as a dancer. So I started dancing when I was 4, and I became professional by the time I was 12. I was classically trained in ballet, and then from there, I eventually got into musical theater, left home the day after high school graduation and started performing. And it wasn't until my early 30s, I was in Chicago by that point, and I was teaching at a college level. I was teaching at Columbia College and Roosevelt University. I was performing regionally in the evenings and choreographing all over the place. And I had a career-ending injury. And I decided to walk away from theater, which was kind of a big deal. I had been in it for forever. So I took 5 years off, and the thing I missed most about theater was the collaborations. So at the time I was doing life coaching and speaking, and I started taking classes at Chicago Dramatists with Arlene Malinowski, solo show classes. And then I found a gentleman who's still there. He's amazing, named Scott Whitehair. Arlene is still there as well. And took storytelling classes. And I moved here to the East Coast, to Connecticut. My mom was sick at the time. She had been diagnosed with Lewy body dementia. And then I lost her. And I kind of got into the practice of daily writing. And I've always been a journaler, so writing's been a part of my life. But I started kind of doing more exercises, tour solo shows, storytelling. And eventually I had a character show up named Annabelle Jones, who's in a play of mine. And I wrote a direct address monologue about her. And basically she wouldn't leave me alone. So I ended up with I was kind of writing every day, like a half an hour a day. So I ended up with scenes for a first act of a play and had it read with a group of people that I knew here who were actors. And they were like, what happens? And I was like, I have no idea. So the second half was much harder to write because people knew about it. Like the first half, nobody knew it. And all of a sudden I was like, oh, maybe I'm a playwright. So that was how it all kind of happened.
Now I'm fascinated by this because, you know, most people's trajectory in theater is you get a lot of people that are playwrights that are actors or have kind of migrated over into, you know, they've done one portion of it. And then they, you know, just kind of somehow find their way to wanting to write their own scenes or come up with their own stories. Directors have done that before too, because they kind of tackle text.
Absolutely.
You coming from a dance background is very unusual. Again, obviously it happens, but it's not the usual path that you would find playwrights, you know, starting from. So talk a little about that. How did a beginning in dance? I mean, obviously you said you had an injury which caused you to switch disciplines, but how did that journey happen?
Yeah, I really think I was like, did I say this before? Yes, I did. I was like, why does that sound familiar? I really think I was kind of like the last generation, I think, who was trained on story ballets in classical ballet. So we really learned Coppelia, Giselle, Les Sylphides, Graduation Ball, all of them. And the emphasis on those ballets is storytelling. I mean, there's beautiful technique and you learn all sorts of things, but you do learn storytelling. So I think I was really connected to it from that point on. And I had always written, and I remember in fourth grade, I actually wrote a book with my friend Sarah Bear, and Sarah had just learned the word retorted. So everybody in this book was retorting to each other. So I always liked to write, but I never felt that I was skilled enough or I'm terrible at grammar. So I had these hindrances. So I think when I was injured and I was just kind of doing it for myself and starting through solo show made it more personal. And that also made it easier, that transition of like kind of telling your own stories.
I am going to go full fanboy on you here because, and this is, you know, this, I can't tell you the amount of
good for my ego.
I know it's good for your ego and you've already heard it. And Laura and I are experiencing serious deja vu at this moment in this interview. It's the strangest thing. When we were speaking before, you know, your play, we're going to talk a little bit about your play Magpie here in a little while, which I am a huge, huge fan of. I think it's absolutely just a stellarly written play. It's got two of the greatest roles for women in it. And but there is a, you know, you bring up this whole idea of ballets and lyrical storytelling, and your writing feels like it's very lyrical. And I believe I asked you before, whenever you are in the midst of writing, does music inspire you? Is it playing in the background or not? Do you prefer to not have music?
Yeah, it's such an interesting question. And strangely enough for me, I don't think when I write plays, I don't think I've ever listened to music. I do when I'm writing or working on like novels or other types of writing, but plays, I think particularly it's just because it's so dialogue driven, obviously, I tend to not have the music on. But I do very much feel that musical theater and my experience with musical theater and dance and ballet has affected the way I structure plays and the way that I feel the happenings within the play.
All right. Well, let's see, you are in Guilford, Connecticut, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Yes. And tell us a little bit about the theater scene there in Guilford, Connecticut. That's one of the things that I always like to, is people are, you know, a lot of times people will travel or they'll go to other parts of the country, you know, visiting people, and sometimes they'll catch a show. What is the theater scene like in Guilford?
Absolutely. So Guilford is a lovely little town, New England town. We're on the shoreline of Connecticut. We are between New Haven and New London. So if that helps people know where we are. We have a lot of local community theaters. We have a lot of youth theaters. And then there are quite a few regional theaters. So we have the Ivoryton Playhouse. We have Playhouse on Park up in Hartford, Theater Works, Hartford Stage. There's a regional theater in Brantford called Legacy. We also do, I think in New Haven and Hartford, there are tours that come through that hit there. And New Haven's famous for Long Wharf, which was long there in a permanent home they've recently left, and now they're doing site-specific work. But so we have quite a bit of theater around here, and we're only 2 hours from New York, around 2 hours from New York.
So what is it like? So, you know, a lot of theaters, you know, what am I trying to say here? A lot of the various places in the United States, they have a lot of places where theater is actually developed, you know, and in some places they just simply perform plays that are already pre-existing. Right. I know you have actually, well, for starters, everybody, tell everyone exactly, you've lived in a variety of places. Where are some of the other places and stuff
yes.
that you lived whenever you were, you know, kind of developing yourself and learning your craft?
Yeah, I grew up in Tidewater, Virginia, which is Norfolk, Virginia, which is in the Tidewater area, which is a huge, was the world's largest naval seaport, but it also is a huge arts area, which is fascinating. We had an opera and a ballet and a First National tour still come through Norfolk. I lived in New York, in Manhattan specifically. I lived on Long Island. I lived in Jersey City. I lived in Chicago, all over Chicago, and then back to the East Coast. So Chicago was an amazing town as a performer, but now as a writer, I'm like, oh, there's just so much theater in Chicago. And a lot of it, they're very supportive of their writers. So unfortunately, if you're not a Chicago-based writer, it's harder to get your work into places. But it's such a beautiful town and a beautiful theatrical community. And I'm learning here. I'm starting to see. And we do have to go back and answer your other question. There's a place here called Green Stage. I think they've changed their name. I think it's Green Stage Live Arts Festival. And they do a festival every other year that supports development with artists. So I had a play developed by them last year, which was an amazing experience. And there are a few others, like Ivoryton Playhouse has a women's initiative, but they do take submissions from all over the country. So you're not guaranteed as a local or anything, but they do. There's quite a bit of support. But I think we talked about before, there's a lot of kind of support for on the page more than that development on the stage. So that is a trickier thing to find.
Do you think it's hard to kind of channel all of that stuff together? You know, because a lot of it's kind of the same thing that I've seen in like the writers that are in the New York City area. Like they will get together and they will, you know, they'll work a lot in apartments and in people's homes and everything in order to try to, you know, get something together and just go through multiple drafts and get ideas from other writers and all that. Do you find that in your area, there's a lot of that going on? Or you talked about it was a play that you had that was kind of developed a little bit. What was that like?
That was amazing. So that was such a great experience. It was Green Stage that did it for me. So I had a week in development, and I was fortunate enough to have my director be a former student of mine. So somebody that I had trained in dance and musical theater at Columbia College, and he came in as my director, and we had a week in the room with people, and then we had a public reading, which was just amazing. And to see, one of the things they asked for was an abridged version of the play. And I have to say, because it was a very long play, an epic play, as I like to call it, that having to abridge something was so good for the revision process, because it forced me to go, well, what happens if I take this out and I take this out, or I, you know, how do I condense that? So it actually served the play in the long run quite a bit.
Now, it's funny that you bring up revisions, because this was something that we talked a little bit about before, was the fact that you were in, how did you refer to it? You're in the middle of rejection season, right?
Yes, exactly.
And real quick, before we go into that, you know, you talked about how it was a former student of yours that was working on that. What is the biggest advice that you think that you would give students in dealing with rejection season? First of all, explain what that is. And second of all, the whole revision process. Particularly, you know, you have an interesting vantage point with this because you're right. You write plays, but you've written novels at the same time. And you know, a lot of times for playwrights that are still in their own development path, letting go of certain things is very difficult early on.
Absolutely.
And you know, just what advice would you give them on that? And again, rejection season. What is that?
Well, so rejection season, as playwrights specifically, we are all submitting around the same time because we all have the same deadline for the big development things. And so we all tend to get our rejections and or our yeses at the same time. So it becomes this season where your inbox is every time. Like I do say to people, you know, text me because I avoid my inbox. Some days are worse than others. So I avoid my inbox. And the big thing with rejection that I think I've learned is, And I know I said this before, it's about dance. Like when I was a dancer, your rejection was all personal, right? It was all about your physical being for the most part. It could be about your technique, but it was really about how you looked. So being a writer, there is that space, which is nice. So it's not about that. But I've learned to also believe, I really believe in aligned collaborations. And when I came back to theater, I was like, I'm only coming back if I can work with people I want to work with. And I want to work with people who really want to be in the room. I love being in the room. So I do believe that if you can look at rejection as kind of clearing your path to the opportunities that are aligned for you, it's helpful because we all get rejections and, you know, some days and some years are worse than others. And as far as like advice, I think the biggest thing is staying true to who you are and figuring that out, because I think as a writer, it takes time to really figure out what you're trying to write about. And not that that doesn't change over the years, but not being too influenced that there is a quote unquote right way to write, right? Trusting your voice. I one of the amazing experiences I have had is I have a writing certificate through the Dramatists Guild Institute of Dramatic Writing. So I've worked with all living playwrights, see Julian Jimenez, Paul Matthew Amos, who's having a huge moment right now. He was just at Steppenwolf. Sherry Wilner, I'm trying to think of people, Emma Goldman Sherman. And the amazing thing about studying with working living playwrights is they understand the value of your unique voice. And that is something I don't think we're told as writers enough, particularly young writers in spaces. So trusting your voice, not that you don't have a lot to learn about structure and all the other things, but trusting that, you know, we look at things like Angels America or other plays that people said couldn't be done until they were done.
You used a term, your voice, which I think is obviously very different whenever you're writing prose as opposed to whenever you're writing right. You know, for the stage. I'm curious about how you would define the term your voice when you're writing for multiple characters.
That's a great question.
Yeah, that is because, you know, we see all these different writers that we have been used to, you know, seeing multiple versions of their work. You go back, Tennessee Williams, you know, Paula Vogel, Lillian Hellman, Neil Simon, all of them. I mean, they write multiple characters. And it goes all across different ages and genders and all that other stuff.
Right.
But the voice of the playwright is still there. David Lindsay Baer is another one.
Absolutely. I was just thinking of him. Yes.
You know, so how would you define your voice if you were explaining what your voice, not your voice, Laura's, but
right.
your
Absolutely.
Voice.
Yeah.
How would you explain that to a young writer?
I think it's the accumulation of all of your experiences, your beliefs about your experiences, I think it's your beliefs and thoughts about it, your experience too. And I think like that somebody actually asked me about Magpie the other day and would I ever go back and I don't know if they were asking me if I would revise it. And I was like, no, I'm not the same writer I was when I wrote it. So I do, you know, our voice evolves, but part of owning your voice where you are is not, we all imitate to learn, but making sure you are trying to write what you want to write. That's to me a part of your voice.
you said another thing now that was just very, very, very interesting to me, because, you know, there are one of the things that, you know, again, we talk about the revision process and going back and do you think, and then obviously this is solely your opinion and I understand that, absolutely, but I'm fascinated by this. Is there a timestamp when you can actually go back and revise a play? Do you think that at some point you because you're it's wonderful to sit there and think about, you're right. You write a play whenever you're one age, and then daily experiences are coming in, absolutely, that are kind of peppering, you know, who you are at this point. And then if you go back and you try to write it, then it's almost like you have it to some degree. And this is a extreme example, but it feels like to me that there would be certain instances where it would be like a teenager, mm-hmm, and a 50-year-old,
yeah,
writing the same thing. And there would be things in the play that would, some things would work, but some things would be completely at odds, because even though they're the same writer, they are two different people.
Absolutely.
That are working on that. Do you agree with that?
I do. And I think I'm trying to remember who, I don't even remember the old podcast that was on. It was through American Theater Wing. I think it was Downstage Center. And I remember one playwright talking about this, because I do think it's a really personal thing. I think some playwrights go back and do it. And I feel like with Magpie, if it got big enough productions, I would probably go in technically and just make sure that things were the way I want. But emotionally, I think it's hard, because I think your perspective changes. I think when you're writing particularly very personal things, or I don't know, plays that are, you're writing them at the time you're writing them, because they're important to you. Like they need to be written at that time. So coming back is hard. You are not in that same place, and you have a different perspective. So I think you can affect the work that you've done.
Yeah, I know. I think about that, because there's several like plays of mine that I wrote years and years ago that, yeah, I thought about going in and doing revisions on them. And then I found it rather difficult to go back in, and something that would that came across, and it was so easy to write the first time, when you have, you know, 95% of it right there in front of you, and all you have to do is go back and change things. Yeah. It's really difficult, and I don't know how, you know, I mean, there's a lot of writers, you know, there's this new production of Shrek that is mm-hmm, out right now, and you know, Shrek is, you know, David Lindsay Baer and Jen Tesori and all them, they went back into it and changed it. And, you know, it's had this shelf life for how many years now, a decade, yeah, or whatever it is that it's been out there. And I'm like, I'm not, how in the world do you get back into that and then know exactly how, what to redo, because you are 10 years older than you were, yeah, you know, 15, maybe whenever it first started development,
sure,
and all that, and go back and just change stuff. And
it's an interesting question, because I think in some ways, like technically, right, you theoretically grow and get stronger. So technically you may be able to go back and go, oh, I know how I can make this work now. I know how to get the arc to work, or this has been missing and I can make it better. But as far as getting, like we were talking, into voice or emotional, like I think that can be really challenging, because depending on what you're writing, but if you're writing something that came from that place of where you were and your resistance against it, or just your lived experience, and now your lived experience is completely different, it's hard to get back into that space or to even feel what you felt.
Right. I mean, you know, here I am all of a sudden now, this is turned into portion of the David Lindsay Abair show. But then, you know, you look at like Kimberly Akimbo, and you know, from, yeah, when he wrote that initially in the play form, and then I wonder how difficult it was to go back in and know exactly what to take out and change, mm-hmm, and all that, in order for like musical numbers to go in and all that. That had to be, yeah, incredibly difficult to do that, especially again with given the age that something had been in this other sort of medium, and then you're going, yeah, and then changing it. So, I mean, that would be something.
Yeah.
All right. So, again, while we're talking about this, you started off as a dancer,
mm-hmm,
gradually made your way over into theater. As you made that transition, were there any playwrights that jumped out and stood out to you that influenced you and your writing?
Absolutely. I mean, I always say, like, and unfortunately, I'm going to do the research sometime because there are snippets in my head of plays that I remember from my youth that always stuck with me that were dramatic plays, which is not, you know, which is where I've ended up. But I don't know any of those writers. But as I've come up, it's people like Lauren Gunderson has had a huge impact on me just because she's so woman-centric and empowerment-oriented. And she's an extremely generous playwright who taught us all classes during the pandemic and did all sorts of amazing things. Robert Harling, who wrote Steel Magnolias, seeing that play, I saw that play when I was a dancer, when I lived in New York. I saw it off-Broadway in this tiny, tiny little black box theater, and just being in that space for people who don't know the play and only know the movie, the play is only the women and it only takes place in Truvy's hair salon. So it's such a fascinating play because it's in this contained space. And then, you know, then there's hundreds of them, Paula Vogel, the list goes on and on.
All right. Well, that's a good list. Very good list. We want to talk a little bit about your play Magpie. I cannot tell you the number of people that I have suggested this play to, because this play, I think this play is brilliant. And if you don't, we're going to put the link in the comments below on this. So if you do not have a copy of Magpie, by all means, go get one. If you're in New York, there's a couple of copies in the Drama Bookshop. Go down there. If they're sold out, get the Drama Bookshop to order some more. Because yes, it's just fantastic. It's got two just absolutely dynamite roles for women in it. So let me read the story, synopsis rather here. Yes. The play is for two men and two women. Magpie is a story of identity, transformation, and sacrifice. With the support of her therapist, Maggie is beginning to claim her own story. Risking her troubled relationship with her mother, she searches to learn more about the father she doesn't know. But can she summon the strength to find the one thing she needs the most? Herself. Okay, so there's a lot to unpack there. Take it away. Tell us a little bit. Tell everyone a little bit about Magpie. Tell a little bit about the story. And then if you would, take us back through the whole development process of how Magpie came to be.
Absolutely. So Magpie is a very important play to me because it deals with multiple things. It deals with obviously mother and daughters. It deals with mental health. It deals with the power of kind of strangers in a way, impacting our lives, validating our lives. The way Magpie started was when I was a dancer in Chicago, I was taking night classes at Wilbur Wright Community College, and I had a teacher named Mr. Buckley, who taught me Comp 101, and he gave us an exercise to write something that was extremely personal and also universal. And I chose to write about going to see my father's grave, and I didn't go home for Christmas. I went to see my father's grave. So that's kind of the seed of Magpie and where it started. And I wrote that, and when he turned the papers back out, on the top of my paper, he had written, my paper was covered all in red marks because my grammar is atrocious. And he wrote, "Are you a professional writer? You should be." And I was kind of like, I took the paper to him and I was like, "What is happening?" You know? And he was so kind and so supportive and was like, "You are a great storyteller. And there are always people to hire to help with grammar or editing or whatever you need. Don't let that stand in the way." So that seed was planted. And when I had moved to Connecticut, I was performing here and there as a straight actor, and I had begun writing. A gentleman by the name of Eugene Selico taught a playwriting class. There were like three of us. And I took the class and I decided to start expanding that. So it became something called Mama and Me, and it was just a few scenes. And I was trying to figure out what story am I telling? Like, I had the cemetery, but I was like, what supports that? What's around that? So that became a process. And eventually I went to the Pauling Theater Exchange, which is now the Connecticut Theater Exchange. And I should have looked up Kent's name between conversations, which I did not, but his wife's name is Tracy Liz Miller. And it was a great residency. It was 4 days. And I came in and they gave me a director and actors, and I met amazing people there. David Hamilton being one of the amazing actors I met who has supported the project since. And they read the play. They gave me feedback. I went away, wrote, did edits, came back. They read it again, went away. Same thing. And eventually we had a public reading at the end of the weekend. And that was so helpful. And then after that time, I had sent it to a director who I admired. And they, and I got an email that was basically like, you know, it's a cute story, but it's not a play. Very dismissive. And it made me so mad that I was like, this is a play and I have to figure out how to write it. So I hired my old teacher, Arlene Malinowski from Chicago. And we did sessions and just having somebody kind of help continually ask me, what are you trying to say? Because this is what's on the page. You're saying you want to write this. This is what's on the page. And so we went through a process of that. And then I worked with a local group and just had actors read the scenes, you know, and continue to work on it that way. And then it won, a reading here at a theater called the Chestnut Street Playhouse. And I got to see it. And that was kind of one of the moments where I was still working on Mama and Maggie in the fight scene, but there were two powerhouse actresses that just went for it. And I was sitting in this theater in the back seat and I just was like, oh my gosh, it's a play. It's a play. It's going to be a play, because I could just see it because they were so good and they had stuff to dig into and they really helped me hone it. And then this wonderful person named Jean published it from Next Stage Press. And yeah, that's kind of the story of Magpie. Well, and I'm still trying to get in the world.
You should talk more about that Jean guy and how awesome.
Right?
Yeah, I know. there is, what do you think, again, from your own words, if you know, the characters of Maggie and Mama are so absolutely just awesome. Talk a little bit about what that was like, actually, writing for both of those characters. I know we keep harkening back to the last time because, you know, we had this discussion, but we were talking earlier about number one, the voice of, you know, your voice being in both of the characters, but mm-hmm. You have your protagonist and you have characters that come across as an antagonist in a show.
Right.
But even characters that are antagonistic to your main character, from their vantage point, they seem justified in what they're doing.
Absolutely.
So, number one, what character did you fall down on the side of? And then what was it like writing for the other character?
Yeah. I mean, I totally related to Maggie, but I also really related to Mama. Mama was harder because I think it's challenging sometimes when you have somebody, Mama's biggest weapon is silence. And that is hard. It's hard. I didn't want her to end up being one-dimensional, two-dimensional. Like I had to work on making sure there was subtext there for an actor to really find her intention. And why? Why does she use silence? Why is that her go-to? And I don't answer that in the play, and that's for an actor to find, but I think there's enough in there for them to connect dots to make some pretty good choices. And Maggie was also challenging because a lot of people in the beginning were like, she's whiny, particularly men, which was why it was such an impact when the play spoke to you, because I'd had a lot of men be like, oh, she's just whiny. And I was like, no, she's got trauma.
Well, it's no secret on that, at least, you know, between you and I, I've told you that the play reminds me so much of the struggles that my own mother had with, you know, my grandmother and her mom. Yeah. There's such a deep well there for storytelling, you know, with parents and children, you know.
Absolutely.
I laughed about it last time. Mothers and daughters seem to be an awful lot of them, who knows? For fathers and sons, they probably would, yell at one another for a few minutes and then, throw a couple of rocks and then go fishing, you know, the guys down right. In the South. But for Southern women, there's a huge deep well. And I think there's universal themes and stuff that are there.
Absolutely.
So why do you think that that's such a huge kind of element in storytelling with that, you know, parents and children?
Yeah. I think it's so much, it's such a generational, you know, I think there's been, I don't want to use the word facade is coming to mind, and that's not really fair, but I think there's always been this, we have to look like as parents that we are strong and perfect in all of these things, you know, because we're holding everything together. And I think generationally, I mean, there have always been people, right? I always say with Mama and Maggie, like Maggie is a seeker, Mama is not. That they're just very different in that way. Mama doesn't is not interested in the answer. She knows how to get through. She knows how to be strong. She knows how to get things done. And Maggie wants to understand everything. So just coming to life, they're coming at such a different perspective of how they look and how they process. And does that happen? Like, it would be interesting, which I don't know the answer, but is like mama's mother like Maggie? Like, is there, you know, every other generation, are we connecting? I don't know. It'd be an interesting question to ask.
So here's a, you know, when I first read this play, for me, it felt very much of the era that my mother and grandmother grew up in. Mm-hmm. That universality, how do you think that that will continue to manifest itself as we go forward and, you know, into the future? In the future, the look of the world is going to change, but I have a feeling, you know, that universality between parents and siblings is not going to go away.
And yeah, parents and children. Yeah. Well, and I think you're always going to have people, right, who believe that vulnerability is a strength, and you're always going to have people who believe vulnerability is a weakness. So right there, you're coming, you know, you're everything you're talking about, you're coming from two different perspectives.
Yeah. Boy, that reminds me very much of, I think we were talking about earlier, of Lost in Yonkers, Bella and Grandma.
You absolutely
know, the whole thing of you know, one is a strength, one is a weakness, you know.
Yes. Going,
as far as that goes. All right, so this is one of my favorite things to ask you on this, since I, you know, did it 2 hours ago. What is the takeaway for this show that you would like for actors and directors to have, and then what takeaway would you like audience members to have whenever the lights go down at the end of the evening?
It's such a good question, because particularly as a playwright, I think like, ooh, I hope it's meaty enough and layered enough for actors to really be able to make good choices that still align with my text, but that give them the freedom to have that space to really have a good time and get in there. And with directors, I'm hoping that it, for me, the play, I've always wanted it to flow like it's in somebody's head, the way our thoughts move. And I'm hoping that that's on the page as well, so that a director finds that and can have a really interesting time trying to create a play that has that kind of flow without blackouts, without interruptions, but things that keep us curious the way our minds keep us curious. And for the audience, I don't know. I always feel like for this particular play, I don't know that I have anything I want them to take away other than that mental health is important, and that, you know, I believe that we all get to choose our own narrative. So is that something they're also questioning, you know, are they questioning, am I living to my own narrative? Am I living to the narrative that was set for me from my family or whoever? So I'm hoping they're questioning that and kind of looking, like I said before, I think there are people who get Team Mama and Team Maggie. So are they looking at those things and why those characters speak to them?
There is a there's a very interesting character that you have brought into this, because obviously the you know, most of the story sits on Mama and Maggie, but you brought in the character of the therapist in this particular show. The question is, was the therapist? I think you said that there were just a whole lot of different drafts of this show from where
yes,
it started to the other. I wonder, has the therapist always been there? And if so, I didn't ask you this before. This is a brand new question. So talk about that. I'm going to ask you, theater as therapy. You know, what do you think about that? And is theater therapy?
That's a good question. I mean, that's a audience question we could ask, right? I think it can. I mean, one of the things I learned in storytelling, Scott Whitehair actually taught me this, was anything that you're going to write about or perform for the safety of yourself and the safety of the audience, it should be well enough processed. You know, it's challenging if you're doing something that you haven't really dealt with, you have no perspective on, then you're putting the audience in a precarious place where they're not going to feel taken care of, because we want them to be able to take the journey and not feel like, what's happening? Is the person on stage going to, you know, spontaneously combust? So that's interesting. What was the first part of the question? Sorry, I got so sidetracked by that.
No, it was the idea, has the therapist always been with
you? Oh, yeah. So in the very beginning, the therapist wasn't there only because I kind of had scenes. And I think like the therapist came in as a, what was the way to connect all of this and how was she dealing with all of it? And then I knew that I wanted to be able to show Maggie also in her past and how would that happen? And being in therapy is a great place for that because you tell stories. So even though it becomes active on stage, it can start in the therapist's office and then we can have a flashback.
All right. There's a word that you keep using over and over again, and it's hope. Mm. And we talked a little bit about this. You know, there was an old drama teacher of mine back when they were still called drama teachers, you know, not theater teachers, but they were drama teachers back in the 80s. And one of the things that stuck with me all the time was he said that the difference between comedy and drama is that in comedy, there is mm-hmm. no hope. You know, you look at like situational comedies, the characters right. that are in sitcoms, they're doomed to repeat the same mistakes over right. and over again, and they never learn and they never go anywhere. You know, we're just, it's kind of like Groundhog Day in one respect. Mm-hmm. In drama, there is always hope, even though that the situations that the characters are in are, sometimes absolutely terrible. By the end of it, you should leave mm. with a sense of hope that either the characters are going to learn from what they've just been through, or the audience is going to leave feeling hopeful about something in their own lives, or that the characters are going to be okay on mm-hmm. on the other side of where the curtain drops. What are your thoughts on that, since you've written this absolutely brilliant drama?
Oh, you're so kind. Yeah, I mean, I'm a trauma survivor myself, so I am a huge proponent for hope. There's a term that's used often in novels and other places for, you know, trauma porn. And I'm not big on, if it's important to show something that's happened, that's one thing, but I'm big on like seeing the process, seeing someone faced with something and then how they deal with it. It doesn't mean it has to be a happy ending, but it means I feel like I personally want to see that things are possible. Change is possible. Growth is possible. We all have choices. I want to see those things. Those are what are interesting to me.
Well, I think that you've certainly knocked it out of the park on Magpie. I can't believe it. You know, we've gone a whole nother 40 some odd minutes here at this. We've done this is like the fastest 40 minutes ever. Because so, I could just go on. I tell you, I could just go on talking about Magpie forever. But we're almost out of time here. So I want to ask you a couple of other things.
Yeah.
Number one, are you working on something else that you would like to tell us about?
Sure. I'm working on a Christmas play. So, I think it was Lauren Gunderson who I heard on a podcast who said, write a Christmas play. All theaters are always looking for Christmas plays. So I took that to heart. And I'm a huge Jane Austen fan. So I took Sense and Sensibility and took it 8 years after it ended and focused on the youngest daughter, whose name is Margaret. It's a queer play, and it's about her and her love interest, Lavinia. So it's a fun kind of holiday romp, and it's in development right now. And I'm hoping that it will also have a life, because it's kind of a fun, I had never written a holiday play, and I was like, this is kind of fun. You know, I mean, I love The Three Ghosts, nothing against The Three Ghosts, but you want to see, you know, something new and different.
Okay. Now, you know, I'm going to ask you, because I kind of asked you about this before, when you say in development, where exactly is it in development at? Can you at least tell us that?
Yes. Well, I have a friend, her name is Terry Fogel. We created something called Shoreline Playwrights, and we're both middle-aged playwrights who were just like, we need to support each other. So we support each other in development. And we recently had a Zoom reading for that play, and I had amazing actors come in. I have a friend who's a Broadway veteran who's helping me, and I'm trying to get it to the next stage. So I will be shopping around to bigger theaters, but right now it's not quite tight enough to submit to a development process, but we're getting close.
Okay. Well, that's exciting news to hear that. Okay. One final thing, because I'm going to tell everyone the link is going to be in the comments. comments section of wherever you're seeing this posted. So you can go to the Next Stage Press website, nextstagepress.com, and get a copy of Magpie. Go to the Drama Book Shop. I'm going to keep saying that over and over again. how can people follow you and your writing if they want to? You know, once they read Magpie and they go, I have to read more. So how can they follow you?
That would be amazing. I have a website, lauratoma.com. I'm on Facebook, Laura Toma, and I'm on Instagram as laura.tomacoaching.
All right. Well, Laura, we are, we've hit almost the 45 minute mark here. So thank you for coming back and getting together with me again in the same
My
day.
Pleasure.
And yes. We will look forward to definitely seeing more of your work out there. Again, the play is Magpie. Magpie. One word. All right. And we'll look forward to your Christmas show whenever it finally comes out.
Thank you. And I want to thank you. I'm so honored to be a part of Next Stage Press. So thank you so much for your support. It's a great deal.
We are so pleased to have you. All right. Goodbye, everybody.
Bye.
That does it for this episode of the Next Stage Press podcast. Thanks everyone for listening. If you enjoy what you're hearing, please leave us a star rating and a review and let us know what Next Stage Press playwright you'd want to hear from next. Also, feel free to share our show to your theater friends and colleagues. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Shopify, Podomatic, or wherever you get your podcasts, and they are always free to listen to. Also, you can find all of our plays on our website at www.nextstagepress.com, where the first half of our plays are free to read, and licensing info is available there as well. Stay well until next time, and we wish you good health, happiness, and great theater. Goodbye, everyone.